Barry Jenkins, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
This is not a film that one would think studios would get behind, right? It's a complicated, difficult, emotional story. It's a black cast. It's a director who's not known. Tell me how this film got made.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, everything you say is true. It doesn't fit the metrics of what's a studio film or what's a commercial film or a bankable film. And yet I had I'd made a film in 2008 called Medicine for Melancholy.
Yep. With Wyatt Cenac, right?
Wyatt Cenac, right. That we made for about a $15,000 production budget. It grossed like $120,000 at the box office.
Which is a plus, right? I mean, you're in the black.
We're on the marketplace, so I got to state my financials. I met Plan B through that process.
Right, the production house.
Exactly. Brad Pitt's company, Brad Pitt, Dede Gardner, and Jeremy Kleiner, Sarah Esberg. It had been like 5 years since I'd done anything, and I'd written the script. And again, didn't write with any expectations, was really passionate about it. And I was at the Telluride Film Festival in 2013, and I introduced the world premiere of 12 Years a Slave, which is also produced by Plan B. And so myself and my producer, Adela Romansky, who I went to film school with, we ran to Plan B there. You know, and they were like, hey, what are you doing? I was like, well, I actually just came back from Europe writing this script. I adapted this play by Terrell McCraney.
Right.
And that was kind of how the process began.
You and Terrell McCraney, since you brought him up, you grew up. This film is set in Miami, in Liberty City, which is where you grew up, which is where Terrell McCraney grew up, although you didn't know each other together growing up.
Yeah, we lived blocks from one another, and both our moms went through this addiction to crack cocaine, so vividly depicted by Naomi Harris in the film.
Yeah.
And yet we never knew one another, we didn't meet until, I'd say, this process started.
So how much of this story that's told in this film is really you two sort of discovering other facets of y'all's lives, right? If that makes sense.
You know, it began with Terrell in 2003. He wrote the first draft of In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And I think it was very personal and semi-autobiographical. And it was beautiful because when it came to me, it had enough space that I could put my sort of biography, you know, into this character of Chiron, the main character in the film. And once we decided to structure it in these three chapters, then I really found all these in-between places to sort of, you know, place what I call all these memories of what it was like to grow up in this place into the film.
You mentioned memories, and it's interesting because in this film, so much of the story is in the silences, is in the visuals, is in the glances and interactions between characters. How does that translate on the page, right? As you took it out to the actors and the studios, you know?
You know, I tried to write those things, you know, and into the script as subtly as possible. You know, I don't like purple prose. As purple as I got in the script was, there's a moment in the third story after the big phone call between Kevin and Black, where Trevante Rhodes, the actor, is sitting on the edge of the bed. And the script, it says, you know, the length of the phone call. It says 5 minutes, 26 seconds, .. a lifetime.
Wow.
Now, I never expect to film that. But you watch the actor hang up the phone. He sits on the edge of the bed. He has the phone on his temple, and then he leans back. He looks at the screen. He places it on his chest. And so we did things like that to sort of communicate what the space and silence would feel like. And then the actors did a great job of embodying those things.
I will tell you, it was extraordinary. I should have said this a couple of minutes ago, but this film is told in three stages, the three stages of the life of Chiron. I read somewhere that you didn't let the actors playing the character as he ages, right? There's a young boy, a teenager-ish, and then a grown man. You didn't let them watch each other's performances? Is that true?
No. I didn't allow them to meet. Didn't let them watch each other's footage. No rehearsal together.
Because it was extraordinary. I mean, the mannerisms are the same. I mean, they truly could have been the same actor.
You know, I think part of it was, again, I gave them all the full script, you know, and I wrote each of the stories the same way. I tried to direct them the same way. But I felt like the casting process would, that if we did the right job, you know, that we would get these actors who had the same spirit almost. And, you know, part of the movie is this commentary on how the world is projecting this idea of masculinity, this idea of identity onto these young men. And it projects it in such an aggressive way that in the time between each story, the characters become a different person. So I wanted to cast different people to play the same person.
The spaces between those stories actually requires the audience to think and process. You roll in your eyes.
No, I'm not rolling my eyes. I'm agreeing. I'm agreeing in this way that I've had to talk about that quite a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think the audience has to work a little bit, you know? I think when you read a book, you're working a lot. You have to create all the visuals in your mind. I think film is different in that you're presented with sound and image, and so you don't have the same expectations of work. But I think it's like literature. You should do a bit of work to complete the story, you know?
This film says a lot of things about, as you said, masculinity in this society and mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
It also talks a lot about demographics and economics and class and society and work, you know?
See, this is why I'm on the
That's why you're on this program. But it does, right?
No, it does. And we don't talk about that a lot. You know, I love that. You know, Naomi Harris is the only actor who appears in all three stories.
Yep, she plays the mom.
And I love that when you first meet her, she's this working single woman, you know? She shows up in a nurse's uniform. Yep. She's got her badge and everything. And you see over the course of the film, to me, that character's a microcosm of the neighborhood I grew up in that went from this place where there was industry, there were these jobs, and crack cocaine hit, and then you just saw people who were these very almost pillars of the community just hit rock bottom, you know? And with that, you have these kids who now they aren't provided for, you know? They can't eat as much as they did, you know? They're not, nobody's telling them to go to school. All these things ripple throughout. The movie's not about all those things, I must say, people in the marketplace.
As he speaks to the
microphone. All those things are tucked away. But they're there, exactly. If you do an active read of the film, they're there, yeah.
And that scene, the third story or the third slice of this thing where Kevin and Black are sitting in the diner. I mean, Kevin's working in this. He's now made something of himself where, well, I'm not going to give it away, but he has.
Yeah, and as he says, it's a modest life, but it's a life, you know?
Right.
You know, and I think almost like he has sort of come full circle in a certain way. You know, the place Naomi begins is sort of this place that he ends up in a certain sort of way.
Yeah. No,
I mean, they're both wearing a uniform. The only two people in the film who wear a uniform, you know? Simple things, but it's there.
No, but it's actually interesting, and that hadn't occurred to me.
And now he and the other character have switched places. You know, Kevin's the cool guy. He drives a car, things like that. In the second story, third story, now it's swapped. He's got to get a ride home or catch the jitney. You know, which if you're from Miami, it's like a black market economy. These little buses that these guys from the Caribbean start driving. You know, following the bus routes. But there's all these little things if you know that are in there. Yeah.
There is a conversation that's going to be had when Oscar time rolls around. And you're going to be in that conversation. This film is going to be in that conversation. And juxtaposing there somewhere is going to be this idea that we've seen for a couple of years now of Oscar so white. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on that are twofold. One, it takes a long time to make a film. So this film began about 3.5 years ago. I'm sure some of these other films, Fences, Birth of a Nation, Queen of Cotway, The 13th. I mean, there's just so many of these films this year that all probably began 4, 5, 6 years ago.
And all of which are themed along actors and characters of color.
Exactly. And even more, and take it a step further, you know, predominantly filmmakers of color, like the directors, the writers, the producers. And I think that's a genuine response to the lack of voices, to the absence of diversity, and not a response to this conversation that began, you know, 9 months ago, you know, at the Oscars with Oscar So White.
Yeah.
So I think the response has already begun, and you're seeing it in the work. And to frame these pieces, you know, as a sort of reflection of the conversation that's been had for the last 18 months is a bit false, you know, because I think it takes a bit of the will away from the creators and from the financiers and things like that who have begun to do the work, you know, to address this lack of diversity.
Yeah.
Because it's not for a lack of want on the part of diverse storytellers.
Right. You are here in the middle of what is about to be a very intense period for you. As you think about this film and its place in the conversation that we're having in this country, what do you want more? Do you want people to see this film, or do you want people to talk about this film?
Oh, that's a good point. I think they go hand in hand, though, even especially with the diversity or Oscar So White, this whole thing, the awards. I think it goes hand in hand. I think the more people are talking about the film in that way, the more, I mean, this is a small film. You've seen it. It's a challenging piece. And yet, so far, the box office has been tremendous, you know, relative to the budget and the amount of screens we've been on. And I think because people are talking about us in this way, framing the film as a response to this or a reaction to that, it just means someone who either needs to see themselves or wants to see themselves is more likely to hear about the film. And so in that sense, I think they go hand in hand. I want people to both talk about the film And see the film. And I think it's the kind of film that if you see it, you're going to want to talk about it. You know?
Yeah, it's
which
totally
is which this amazing thing that's been happening.
It's totally true. People are going to talk about you in this movie, and one of the things they're going to say is, where the hell did this guy come from? I mean, you know, you're a youngish guy, and you've done a couple some other things, but it's been a while since you had the buzz with the first film you made with Wyatt Cenac at South By. What you been doing? Where you been?
You know, I work with some really good people, man. I worked at Focus Features on a project with John Lyons and James Seamus. Cool project. It was about Stevie Wonder and time travel. I was probably biting off more than I could chew.
That's kind of high concept.
Dude, it was awesome. It was very high concept. Probably too high concept for a guy like me. And then I adapted a memoir. And, you know, that was pretty much the first 5 years after Medicine for Melancholy. And I think the problem there was I'm not Stevie Wonder, you know. And I'm not this guy in this memoir, you know? Yeah. It wasn't personal. And I think maybe despite the fact that I'd already made a film, typically your first film was very personal, that movie still wasn't about where I was from. So I think I had to make this film to get to the point where now, you know, theoretically it won't be another 8 years, you know? Because right. I don't need to get to that part of my self-expression.
Cart way before the horse here, but you're now at the position where your phone's going to start ringing.
My phone does ring, man. It does ring. It does ring. But you know, when I look at it, you know, there are people who were with me through those whole 8 years, through those whole 5 years, you know. And when I see those names, you know, I'm picking up.
Then you're picking it up.
Right away, you know. The other names are cool, too, but those are the names that I'm picking up right away.
You made this movie for $5 million, plus or minus?
Minus, yeah.
Less than $5 million.
Yeah, less than five.
What do you want? Do you want a critical success or do you want a financial success?
I want a critical financial success. No. I mean, look, when you go 8 years without making a piece and you make a piece that's challenging in this way, and I don't mean because it's a black film or it's a queer film or it's a poor film, you know, the movie's inherently intersectional, but it's also structurally challenging, you know, visually it's aggressive, you know, and I haven't made a film in 8 years. And so, you know, for Plan B and A24 and Adela Romansky, you know, to put their names on the line to back this film, I want them to make their money back, you know. I want the movie to financially make them whole because they took the risk on a guy who hadn't made a piece in 8 years, you know, telling a story about his life.
It's interesting to me that you can talk almost in the third person about this movie. You can talk about it being aggressive and visually this and visually it's you've like detached somehow. Is that what happened? You put it in the can and then you got to go on and
no, it's not that. I think as a filmmaker, you know, to do what I do, especially in this film, because some of this stuff was really personal. I mean, in the days that I worked with Naomi Harris, essentially playing this composite of my mom and Terrell's mom, was really intense. And the only way you get through that is to know, you know, I am a craftsperson. I am a filmmaker. I am creating this thing. The thing isn't me. I'm going to put a lot of myself into it. But, you know, it's a movie, you know, and it's the only way I can get through it. The only way I can get through it. And I've been pretty consistent with that. You know, everything that's happened in the last 8 weeks has been amazing. And I remember thinking that this could happen. And so I took like a week to myself before anybody saw the film at Telluride. And I wrote down what I thought the film was, how good I thought it was, what I was proud of, what I wasn't so proud of. And I kind of stick to those things. And so it makes it a bit easier to talk about the film as the film.
As you go into wide release, are you... I guess that's the phrase, right? Wide release that happens today. Are you daunted at all? Or are you a little apprehensive?
Not daunted. I mean, I think I'm trying to place myself into anyone's shoes and have a bit of distance from it. I'm very curious, man. I'm curious to see because I know what's in the film. And, you know, a buddy of mine sent me an email yesterday. He went and saw the film in San Francisco and somebody sat behind him. And this guy was making all these like, oh man, no, not this, during some of the scenes in the film. Yeah. And he was like, but the guy stayed through the whole movie.
Yeah.
Didn't get up, didn't walk out. Stayed through the whole thing and was dead quiet when the film ended. And he was like, even if you didn't change that guy's mind, he saw something that he hadn't seen before, you know? And again, that's a conversation that he's going to go and have with someone else. So I'm very curious to see what the people between the coast going to think of the film, not financially or critically. I'm just curious to see.
It's a film called Moonlight. Cannot recommend it highly enough. Barry Jenkins, thanks.
Thank you, bro. Marketplace. Kyrie's now. Man, I never thought I'd be on your show, man.
Well, here we are.